Welcome to Cloudlandia.
Mr. Jackson.
Yes.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
The theme song that plays before the podcast starts, we never get to hear her side of the story.
Maybe that's true. Maybe she's like, she doesn't want, but maybe she wants him to.
I mean, he says she's shy, but, you know, and why is he saying all these things? Is there some suspicion that he's running around and, you know?
No, I think it's the nice guy anthem is what it is. She's not interested in him. And he's saying, but I'm never going to let you go. I'm never going to run around. I'm never going to desert you. I'm never going to. Why not me? Because she's interested
in the guy that
she can't have.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because it points out the difference between jealousy and envy. Okay.
That's true.
That he thinks he's got something, but there's a possibility he could lose it. And that's jealousy. Envy is where somebody has something and you want the other person to lose it, you know?
Yes.
So, yeah. Words are important.
They really are. Those are you know, culturally important words that Rick Astley is you know,
yeah,
a poet for a generation.
Yeah. You know, I read that, you know, I've told you in the past, I've read this massive book by a German author. He wrote it in the 1960s and it was called The Envy. And he points out something interesting about envy, because envy is a human constant. You know, it's going on all the time. But he said, if you look at the psychological research starting probably in the 1880s, and you go forward, they list every sort of psychological problem that human beings have. But starting around 1880, envy disappeared as a human problem. He said it was a constant in human literature, philosophy, drama, you know, in stage plays and everything else. But he says starting around 1880, it just disappears. And if you bring up envy at a psychological conference, everybody goes mute. Nobody talks about envy.
And why do you think that is?
Well, because they're all envious.
Ah, okay. I see. That's funny.
Actually, the modern world, which is sort of based on the concept of meritocracy, in other words, that, you know, everybody has an opportunity to develop themselves as far as they want to. I mean, there's a belief in that. I think it's more of a belief than it is a reality. But I think that meritocracy, the notion that everybody's equal and that it's simply a matter of applying yourself that determines your outcome. I think it, some people are up to that game and some people aren't up to that game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And my feeling is that the people who have been told that they're equal and that their success in life is totally dependent upon their efforts, they feel kind of outgunned right from the beginning. They're outcompeted right from the beginning because they can tell who just have greater intelligence, greater creativity, greater skill, greater advantages. And it makes them very, very envious. But since envy is not discussed as a subject, they're caught up in their envy. And so what they do, instead of admitting to their own envy and saying, well, I'm envious of this, what they say is there's something wrong with the world, then we've got to change the world outside so that I don't feel this way. So I think the reason is that instead of people taking responsibility for their experience, more and more they've said, we've got to change society so that I don't feel I don't feel inferior. Anyway, that's my thought.
Their fault. Mm-hmm.
Their fault. Their fault. No, there's something wrong with the system. There's something wrong with the system. Yeah.
And, yeah, we got to change the system so it feels better in my to my advantage. Makes things easier for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And my sense is that the news media is very much about this because they're constantly finding faults with the system. I mean, if you look at the COVID experience over the past year, how much criticism has been coming from the news media?
Oh, but you know, it's so much better now under Biden. It's everything is rosy now.
Well, it certainly improved very quickly.
Oh, yes. I mean, oh, so funny.
Well, it was very, very interesting. I was having a conversation with somebody, and they said, boy, the news over the last, the last 3 or 4 weeks has just been crazy. You know, the news has been crazy. And I said, well, I think maybe the news media is crazy. And the reason is Trump isn't saying anything.
Yeah. It's true, isn't
what
it?
Happens
it's been
to
so
the news
quiet.
Media, what happens to the news media if Trump doesn't say anything?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, they're so...
Yeah, you know, the stock prices of the media companies are going to go down fast if Trump doesn't hurry up and say something.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe he's going to open up... he'll show up on Clubhouse or something and break the internet.
That'd be interesting.
It would be. I mean, imagine the rally you could have on Clubhouse.
You don't mind me asking, because I know you're on Clubhouse. How many, mm-hmm. how many followers do you have?
I would say I'm in it, but not of it, Dan. So let's see what I've got right now. I'll tell you exactly, because here's the extent of what I've done on Clubhouse. Right now, I have 3,100 followers on Clubhouse,
and without any effort or initiative whatsoever.
That's true. Yes.
So does this mean that people will check out whether you're actually right now this moment on Clubhouse or not? So they're on the lookout for anything that. Where you're in.
I think that's what it is. Like I noticed that. So you get notifications when something's going on Clubhouse. So if, and here's the extent of what I've done. People have like pinged me into a room. So if they're doing a room, they can send out, you know, notifications. Hey, invite Dean, invite Dan, invite whatever. So I see whoever it is, I'll see that Kevin Harrington was doing a room a few nights ago, Thursday, and they pinged me to come in. So I came into the room. They had about, you know, 1,500 people, 1,800 people in the room. Yeah. And so I got to share some stuff. And then all of a sudden, you know, ding, 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 you get all these people following you. And I've done that a few times in other people's rooms where I've popped in and they'll go, oh, Dean Jackson's here. Let's see what he has to say. And you know, make a contribution. And then while you're talking, people are, oh, let's check out Dean and follow Dean. And so that's how it happens. I've done one room where I opened a room myself and I just put up 10-minute marketing hot seats with Dean Jackson and opened it up and it automatically pings people who are following. And at that time, I think I had maybe 500 followers or something at that point.
Yeah.
And I opened it up and had about, 80 people come in, including Paris Lampropoulos. So I brought Paris in and made him a moderator with me. And we just did marketing hot seats for about 45 minutes. And then I had to run. I had to go and, you know, close it up. So it was, I think what it really brings is an audience on demand. You can pick a topic.
Well, Well, we're comparing Cloudlandia to the real world. So let's just take what you did. Let's just take not the real world, but the mainland.
Mainland, yeah.
Because they're both real worlds. They're just different worlds. So take that and just reverse engineer what you did. You know, and can I ask you a question? How much thinking about this did you do before you actually opened the room for
I was like, I wonder what would happen if I open a room. And I said, how do I do this? Because I just wanted to go through the motions of seeing what it is, thinking that, you know, I didn't tell anybody I was doing it. I didn't announce it or send out invitations for it. So I was prepared for whatever happens. If one person comes, then hey, we'll talk about marketing, and it not to be the worst thing that could happen, right? And because I didn't think nobody would come, but even if one or two or you know a dozen people come, you've got a nice little conversation. It's conversation on demand. That's really what I think it is, you know.
You know, this is a fascinating capability. First of all, I'd like to introduce the whole notion, you know, in the mainland, ever since when humans were first identified as humans, which, you know, there's a lot of contention about this, but it's about 100,000 years that we're different from anything else, you know, like humans are clearly different. And there's various what they call humanoid people. And the most famous of the humanoids that are kind of like us, but not like us, are the Neanderthals. And but there's about, I think there's at the 100,000 mark, there are about 16 different humanoid variations and isolated from each other for the most part. And there's been some sort of crossover where we clearly weren't primates anymore. We weren't gorillas or we weren't chimpanzees. We were, you know, we were operating differently. Mm-hmm. So it's been about 100,000 years. And one of the things that happened immediately is that class systems developed, and there's a lot of whimsical theorizing that in the old days people were very egalitarian and they shared everything and nobody had more status than anyone else. But it's more of a wish for the future than it is a description of the past. In other words, that people are born unequally, you know, unequal in terms of the circumstances, unequal in, you know, what kind of brain you have, unequal in terms of the strength that you have and the skills that you have and whether you're alert or not alert. So anyway, and what happens is that there's very definitely a stratification that happens in all human societies where some people are better than others and some people get rewarded more than others. And you can take everything away from everybody and redistribute it equally to everybody. But in about a year, 20% of them will have 80% of all the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Pareto's Law. This is an Italian economist.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter how you try to equalize human beings. If you let them loose for a year, pretty soon some will have more than others. Mm-hmm. And so what I was watching was Cloudlandia, because there's a myth about Cloudlandia that everybody's equal in Cloudlandia. But your Clubhouse experience tells me that that's not true, that there are some people who are perceived thought leaders in Cloudlandia, and they have a higher status than other people.
That's exactly true. I think you're absolutely right. That everything, yeah, that's true. It's an advantage going into that kind of an environment to be, yes, because people look for the familiar, I think, that there's something.
Well, think about your brain and the development of the 8 profit activators, which you just practiced, actually, during this past week. You've reinforced it with a new group of entrepreneurs who
Strategic coach gentleman from Liechtenstein was on with us, Philip.
Yeah,
and he's great. We had a great time, but we had people.
He signed up. I think he's one of our virtual, we have the global virtual, and I think he signed up he was in the London. Very first workshop that we, global virtual, and we had never had anyone from that country before. So,
there's only 38,000 people in all of Liechtenstein. That's funny.
Yeah.
But we had Hawaii, to Liechtenstein and all points in between. So it was funny.
Yeah. But I've been talking about, I've got a really neat exercise. I don't know if you were on the free zone 2-hour session when I introduced the uncertainty focus. Did you
see
that?
No, I don't think so. No. Mm-mm.
Well, it comes out of my experience with Stephen Poulter, and Stephen, for the audience listening, is a IVF doctor, in vitro fertilization doctor. And, so he helps couples have babies when they've not been able to do it any other way. And so he was feeling very limited and very, very restricted by the conditions of his medical specialty, that they had a journal. So there was a journal, and every medical specialty has a journal. And this is like an 1850s capability, where they have an author, they have a society that controls it. And in every and it comes out maybe, I think probably quarterly, or maybe it comes out monthly. And there's 3 or 4 articles in there. And who gets their articles published is totally, it's totally arbitrary and it's totally political. And then once a year, they have a big conference where everybody comes from around the world, and it involves mainland travel and mainland hassle and mainland time-consuming difficulty. And he said, there's got to be a better way for all the people in my specialty to talk to each other and compare notes and do it, in a much more efficient way. So he created a communication platform, which is called Lodestone. And he's just taken off the shelf digital capabilities, including marketing capabilities and language analysis capabilities and, virtual conferencing. And he's put them all together in one package, and he's actually got a patent on it. But what we were noticing that when COVID started, because IVF, in vitro fertilization, was deemed a non-essential medical specialty, which means they couldn't have any patients. And that went on for about 4 or 5 months, from March until September, October. And how were people going to respond to this? They had to lay off staff. They had to close clinics. And everything, because their specialty was deemed non-essential by, some government official or government, politician. And so what he did is he created a set of about 6 conferences every couple of weeks where all the IVF doctors from around the world could talk about what was true about their experience, what was happening to their patients when they couldn't, you know, they actually couldn't follow through on procedures that they had already started and everything else. And we were talking about what happened in the course of those six conferences. So let's say it was over the course of maybe a quarter and a half. And I said, you know, it's really, really interesting. I'm getting a totally different picture about what a thought leader is in the 21st century, an expert, if you will, but use the word thought leader. A thought leader is the person who can tell you where the border is between that which is certain and that which is not certain.
To tell you the border between that which is certain.
Yeah,
and that
so
which is uncertain.
Let's go a
That's
century
great.
Ago. Mm-hmm. So let's go a century ago and say, what's a thought leader? It's a thought leader is the person who knows everything. The expert is the person who knows everything. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But that can't be true in a world where new things are happening every day and new things are being created every day. A thought leader can't be someone who knows everything because there's no possibility of people knowing what new things are going to happen today, tomorrow, and the next week.
Right. That's a great thing. So knowing this is certain, and this is what we're working on. We're not sure about this yet, that they're right on the border, right on the leading, that's probably the leading edge or whatever, right?
And the whole point is that I don't need to know what I just need to know what I can count on, and then the others is still to be found out. And my sense of confidence doesn't come from knowing everything. It's just knowing kind of the maximum that I can count on, and then I have to have my wits about me for the stuff that isn't known yet.
That's great. And how did you incorporate that into an exercise?
Well, I created that. And Zoom limits me to 8.5 by 11 for the exercises. And that's been a great restriction because I've gotten a lot better at getting, an entire thought process.
You can't have the big 11 by 17. Yeah.
Yeah. So the way I did it, Dean, is I set it up. First of all, there's a first column that says a breakthrough that I'm thinking about, some great new thing I'm thinking about. And kind of, this is what the breakthrough is that I'm looking, and this is why it's really important to me. And, if it works, this is going to be the outcome if this new thing really works, okay? So you write that down. So you're focusing on a particular thing in the future. It's an improvement. It's, it's a what, like in the who, not how. It's the what that I'm looking for. And then you have a column that says what I'm certain about about this. In other words, that there are certain things I already know, things that I've already seen, that gives me the confidence to actually commit myself to producing this bigger and better result in the future. Okay, so I write down everything that I know. I'm pretty sure about this. And then you have a line that comes down that's called the border. And on the other side of the border, this is what I'm uncertain about. Okay.
Mm.
And it was kind of funny because I walked the free zoners through this, and all of a sudden it says, well, how is this different from a strategy circle? How is this different from an impact builder? How is this? Yeah. And I said, well, the difference lies in actually doing the exercise. So I had them, I walked them through it in a normal form, give them so many minutes to do this, so many minutes to do this, so many minutes to do this. And then down at the bottom, I have insights, what's your insight from this? And then put them in breakout groups, and they came back and they said, this is kind of amazing because I find that I don't have, that what the exercise frees you up is from taking a stand on something that you think is going to happen.
Mm.
You don't have to take a stand on it. You just have to say, this is what I'm certain about this, and this is what I'm uncertain about.
There's a, I don't know whether it was, I think it maybe was in The Fog of War. There was that documentary where he was talking about the known knowns and the known unknowns. And that sounds like what you're describing. But he said where the wild card is the unknown unknown. The things that we don't even know that we don't know yet. The things that are, that we could be discovered could be the wild card in that situation. And then, of course, the corollary to that is the things that we know that just aren't true.
Yeah.
That turn out to be wrong. That they, well, that's really,
and I think that I think that's really the biggest weakness is the things, that we're saying, well, we can rely on this because anything opposite this simply can't happen,
right?
And for example, I mean, just go back to a world, a mainland situation. Well, it was mainland and Cloudlandia combined, was the GameStop experience about 4 weeks ago. GameStop, based on the Reddit community who were using a platform called Robinhood, to suddenly have 3 million investors kind of decide, we're just going to support a couple of stocks here that the short, the shorters are punishing right
targeting.
Now.
Targeting,
and we'll see what happens right now. Okay, now if you had interviewed one of the particular hedge fund that was shorting those stocks the day before, he says, you know, we got this one in hand. We'll knock these two stocks out. And the next day they were almost knocked out. So 24 hours later, they were almost, and they lost $3 billion. That's in my world, that's a lot of money. $3 billion is a lot of money.
Yeah.
And, and they had to be bailed out by two other hedge funds. Now the whole point was that nobody in the hedge fund world had any idea that what just happened to this one hedge fund could have happened in the hedge fund world. You know, they, you know, so that was, first of all, they didn't know it could happen. But the other thing is, because of who we are, something like this can't happen to us, but it did, you know, so they just got introduced to a new dimension of reality.
Yes, exactly. Now they've added that to your known knowns.
Yeah.
That was previously unknown. That's right.
Well, it was kind of funny because at the end of the week, somebody wrote an article. He was watching the, you know, because people were taking sides. People were taking sides for the Reddit community. People were taking sides for the hedge fund community and everything. And he said, the only winner out of this whole thing over the last week is the stock market. It just added a new dimension.
Hmm. Yes. Then now it's a that is the great balancer, right?
Yeah.
That's really, yeah. That,
we can hedge the hedgers. There's now a device for hedging the hedgers.
Yes.
And so, but going back to the certainty uncertainty thing, that when we start a project, it's not so much that there are obstacles. It's just that we don't have the information to decide whether it's going for us or going against us. We just don't know. Okay, so you pose it as an uncertainty. Okay, so I'll give you an example. I put down as my project that I think that who, not how, is the central concept in the strategic coach universe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I said instead of seeing the growth of strategic coach as an upward, as an upward slope, and you learn this at the bottom of the slope, and as you go up the slope, you know, you learn these other things. Mm-hmm. Why don't we see it as a circle, and the bullseye in the circle is who, not how. And then as you master who, not how, you go outward concentrically. You go concentrically, and then you know, you have the lifetime extender, you have free focus and buffer days, you have the largest check, you have unique ability teamwork. But these are all driven by the fact that you didn't procrastinate. In other words, you procrastinated, but you didn't do the how, you found a who. And then there's all these different ways of thinking, all the circumstances. So I put it, I put it down as my project. Now, this much I know, first of all, that who, not how is the most instantly communicated concept that I think we've come up with in the entire history of Strategic Coach, you know. And,
that's great.
Huh?
That's great.
No, it is. And, you know, and I always say, well, this is who said it the first time. It wasn't me. It was Dean Jackson. But I said, but I've never said it to anyone where they just didn't immediately get what it was about. And I said, that's a really good
concept. I
remember
the first time, I remember you told me that the first workshop you did after the workshop where we talked about it. And you said you've been saying it to the people after the workshop and never getting met with anything but instant, like, oh my, that's a big one.
Yeah, I've got a next door neighbor who has now bought 8 of the Who Not How books for people. She's in the movie business and she writes books. And she says that there's just so many people I want to give this book to, because she says,
wow,
they're procrastinating. She said they spend half their life procrastinating.
Yes.
So anyway, well, I put this out. Well, I'm certain of this. I'm certain of this. I'm certain of this. But I'm not certain of this. And I said, first of all, what's it going to do to our salespeople? What's it going to do to our program advisors? What's it going to do to our coaches? What's it going to do? And I don't know the answer to this. So there, you know, I'm suggesting what is a fundamental 25-year kind of transformation of how we talk about Strategic Coach. And I said, there's just a lot I don't know. There's just a lot I don't know about this. And so instead of saying, we're going to do this, I'm saying I can see that if we could pull this off, it would be probably a great thing. And I'm confident of this and this and this and this, but there's just a lot that I don't know about it.
Yeah. And let's try it on.
Mm-hmm.
I do. Yes. I think it's really, that helps you identify what do you need. Like, it helps identify the, you know, the questions that come up next. That's the, if you look at that, feeds so nicely into a strategy circle about the unknowns.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is it keeps me from being polarized on the issue. You know, it's kind of like, and what I was noticing in the Abundance 360 as I was watching the week go on, that everybody was polarized with their favorite technology.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that, they say, well, this is going to change everything. You can forget about, you know, you can forget about fossil fuels. They'll be gone in 10, 15 years. And you've got to take a position. And I said, yeah, but, you know, maybe there's a great many great unknowns about this that we just don't, you know, that we just really don't know about this. And rather than taking a polarized position on it, why don't you say, well, this is what I know about it, and this is what I don't know about it. What do you know about it, you know?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you look at a lot of, you know, I there's been a lot of things that we get exposed to at Abundance 360 that I haven't heard any more about since we were first exposed to them. Like, if you go back 7 or 8 years, this was the 8th of it, right? So You go back.
Ninth. This was the ninth year.
Yeah. This was the ninth. Okay. So
yeah.
I didn't go to the first one. I was at the second, but I haven't missed
yeah.
since then. But yeah. the, yeah, but still a lot of those things were, not really, made any advancing. But I think you hit it on the head earlier with the longevity things are the things that are, seem to be making the big strides.
Well, I think the reason is the ones that make the biggest strides are the ones that apply to everybody. Longevity
yeah.
just happens to be something, you know.
Even though we don't know, even though we don't know whether they're working or whether they will
yeah.
work, that's an interesting.
Yeah, but we're bouncing
element too.
You know, I think probably consciously or unconsciously, we're bouncing off every day. Is this worth it today in terms of how many years I still have to live? You know,
right.
Like I think
oh, yeah.
humans, you know, if you're 30 and you think you're going to live to 90, you can try anything. If you're 60 and you think you're going to live to 70, there's only a few things that you're going to get interested
no,
in.
No, that went, I went through exactly that situation with Homer McDonald, the guy I wrote Stop Your Divorce with. When I met Homer in 1998, he was 76 years old.
Yeah.
And I
my age,
thinking,
right? Not my age. My age right now.
But I'll tell you what, Dan, he wasn't your age then. He was older than you then. He was an older 76 than you are a 77, if you know what I mean. And I know that was a definite, like, unknown for me. But if I was looking at it, like what you just said, you're bouncing off things. I perpetually kind of kept Stop Your Divorce as, third or fourth place project because I was uncertain about how much do I want to put into building something on the back of based in conjunction with someone that's 76 years old, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't see a 20 year window, which he actually lived for, you know, to 94 years old. Yeah, still strong and vibrant and, you know, right up to the very end. But
which is great.
Mm-hmm. But if I had known then, if I'd known in 1998 that we had a runway of 18 more years,
yeah,
it would have changed the way that I thought about it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. So longevity, I think, is... I think our consciousness, what we call human consciousness, is really somehow, structured around how long we've lived and how long we still have to live. Like
yeah.
what we value that we want to hold on to, what we, what we would be interested in next. To devote our energies to, you know, to actually focus on and work for. And I think what happens with a lot of people is they, at a certain age, let's say it's 60 or 70, they think that, well, there's nothing more that I can do for my personal life, but I'm willing to devote my time and energy to a collective project like a charity or a political
yeah.
party or anything like that, because they no longer see much progress in their own individual life. They don't, they don't really see that. And I've noticed with more and more people as I become conscious that I'm not doing this, that what I have planned for myself for the next 24 years till, until 2044 when I'm 100 is the biggest thing that I've ever undertaken in my personal life. And I think entrepreneurs really differ from the general population in the sense that they can stay with an individual vision of personal progress for much longer than most people can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all valid. That's an interesting take. You see all these, you know, it's very funny because I'm surrounded. I live in a neighborhood of at a gated community. Most of the people are older than me. I've lived here 18 years. And when I moved in, my thought was, you know, 20 years from now, I'll be old enough to live in here. And you know, it's a beautiful neighborhood. I love it. But I see these people now that that are kind of early 70s or late 60s that are kind of retiring and winding down. One of my friends and neighbors here just retired as a judge, but he was forced to retire at 65.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting thing that, you know, here's a guy that now he's kind of, is this the twilight for him? You know, it's interesting to see that he's, you know, 12 years younger than you, but now it's like come out to the end kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And so his ability to plot an individual impact has been limited because up until then it was granted to him, through the legal system. You know, the legal system actually accelerated him sort of to a very senior position because a judge is a senior position and gave him enormous impact on the world. You know, case by case, he had enormous impact. But on one day, his 65th birthday, it all was taken away.
You're done. And that's my thought, you know, as I see him as I'm driving out, we talk, but he's, you know, he's looking for some kind of project. And I definitely see I think there's so many like judge opportunities in Cloudlandia for, you know, to do something with him.
Yeah, it was very interesting. Joe, at one of the Genius Network meetings, had Sandra Day O'Connor, who was the first, female justice. Supreme Court justice. And she was there and she was about 80 at that time. I think she's still alive, but I think she's kind of lost.
Yeah, those Supreme Court judges, that's a life position.
Yeah. I mean, in many ways, to be a Supreme Court justice in the United States has got to be one of the great jobs, J-O-B-S, in the world.
Yeah.
Because once you've got it, and it's very interesting, I look back at the entire history of the Supreme Court since 1789, because it was instituted as part of the Constitution. And there's only been 113 of them, so it's 230 years. There's only been 113 of them, and that works out. I mean, if you divide 113 into 230, it comes out to average of about 16 or 17 years. You know that each of them is in, and now you know the latest one. This Amy Barrett, who
she's young.
Yeah, and she could put in 40 years easily.
Yeah.
You know, she's in great
shape. It's like a Pope judge. It's like a Pope job.
Like a
You're
queen.
There. Yeah.
Almost like a queen.
Yes, exactly.
Almost,
right.
Almost like a queen, you know?
Yeah.
And, so the whole thing is, going back to your point about Abundance 360 and what, you know, what really, and I'm noticing the minutes and the hours that longevity gains every year in Abundance 360. So like in the very first one that you went to, so this was 8 years ago, longevity maybe had 45, 50 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's got a whole day.
Yeah.
Got a whole day if you put all the time together. And it keeps, you know, it keeps elbowing out technologies that were promised 8 years ago, but they really haven't made much of a mark. Longevity is making a real mark. And I said, the reason is that everybody takes it personally.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm still trying to figure out 3D printing. I mean, is 3D printing, is there anything in my future that's going to require 3D printing? And I came to a conclusion, no, but there's clients of mine that 3D printing will be interesting to. And I'll learn about 3D printing through my clients and their goals and their progress. But I don't need to know anything about 3D printing. I just, you know, it's like the Kevin Bacon thing. I can afford to be one relationship away from 3D printing.
Right. Yeah, I looked 1 degree of separation. That's my whole thing that I really look at, being able to be exposed to what's and who's. That's really what Abundance 360 does for me, is you get exposed to what's possible or what's coming or what's out there in the world. And if you ever need that capability, who to talk to about it. That's the good thing. We've got the we've got the A360 calling card, basically, that would get us, you know, an audience with anybody. Right.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is that you can take a look at every technology in A360 and you say, what degree of separation? Do I need a direct relationship with this, or do I need separation? Do I need, one relationship away from it? Is it two relationships away from it?
Right.
And therefore you can position the importance to you by the number of separations that you can afford to have and still be up to date as far as the world goes.
That's smart. That's an interesting thought.
Yeah. And
I use that 3D printing example all the time, though, in the VCR formula that I forget what the gentleman's name is that had the automotive the parts 3D printing that they do, the big equipment parts for machinery that's out remotely in
Paul
the field.
Heiss.
And
Paul Heiss.
Paul Heiss. You know, the fact that they do tens of millions of dollars a year and are the leaders in the industry, and they don't own a single 3D printer because they're using excess capacity of other 3D printers. And that's, to me, that's a Cloudlandia VCR application. It's beautiful.
Yeah, well, the whole point is that we have our goals. You know, you and I have our goals, and there's a certain number of capability. And Zoom just happens to be a direct relationship. I want to have a direct relationship with this technology. You know.
Yeah, me too. I mean, because that's something that we're gonna use. You know. And I think see, the jury's out on Clubhouse, but I think it's going to be a useful tool. Lee and I were just talking about you.
Here's the thing. Here's the thing that I was going to suggest to you. You got 3.1 thousand or whatever it is right now, 3,000 followers. Multiply it by 10. And it's 30,000.
Yeah.
One day Dean has an idea, and before the end of that idea, he can bounce that idea off 30,000 people.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think that's the thing. I think I said earlier, conversation on demand is really what you've got access to. Put up a topic.
Yeah.
You can ask a question. Talk about, you know, market research or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the innovations,
Yeah, and the other thing is, I got a feeling that the answers you get would be better than 90% of, if you're talking about like sociological or psychological research.
Yeah.
90% of Ben Hardy says, you know, he says 80% of all the psychological and sociological theories in the world are based on 22 to 29 year old graduate students at major universities, mainly in America,
Yeah.
And he says, well, how representative are those 22 to 29 year olds of the human race? He says, not very much. And he said that one reason why, you know, like Who Not How, and we're working on The Gap and The Gain now as our second book. So we have a 10-year ten-year deal with Hay House.
Yeah.
And the Gap and The Gain is the book for this year. And he says, you have to understand, he says, that your basis for research are all successful, ambitious entrepreneurs. He said, that's a very unusual database.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's so...
They're check writers.
Well,
you're not writing
true.
Checks to. You're not writing checks to them. They're writing checks to you. Check writers.
Yeah.
Check writers have a much higher standard of what works and what doesn't work than people are being paid to test something.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. The whole I'm seeing what's happening right now. Have you been in Clubhouse yet?
No. I made a commitment to Lee Richter.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
She introduced me to it. So I just sent her and I'll send you a copy of it. I sent her a fast filter, and I said, these are my conditions. These are my conditions, and this is what I want to get out of it. So I have a meeting with her on Tuesday. I have a Zoom meeting with her on Tuesday this week, and she's going to talk to me. And she says, any way you want it. She says, I'll do it. She says, I'll introduce it. But down the road, the two of us can go on together, and we can have a clubhouse together. We can
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We could have welcome to club, the Cloudlandia Club. it's true.
And I said 2021, March to March, was my Zoom year. And I said, I'm just going to introduce another capability called Clubhouse for the next year, you know, from March to March. And I'll just approach it. This is what I know. This is what I don't know, you know, and everything else. So, and I said, you know, I've got 24 of these years to go. And I said, maybe I'll just make 1 year about some new extension of, you know, Cloudlandia capability.
The next thing. Yeah. Take it, whatever.
The next thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I like that a lot, Dan. So that's, Lee was at my Breakthrough Blueprint this last week, and we were talking about that as a sidebar about bringing you into Clubhouse. But it's interesting for me as an observer to see how it all happens. Like, even in the few weeks that it's been, that I've been involved now, there's a lot of, you know, holy cow, what's this? There's a lot of FOMO. Everybody's like fear of missing out. It's happening. Yeah. You got to get on Clubhouse. You got to get in there and, you know, what's all happening. And, oh my goodness, there's this guy. And, oh, there's this. Or that's what's happening now.
As far as I can see, I hope the founders of Clubhouse realize what they've done. But they've created a counter social media, as far as I can understand it from the outside. And I was just reading an article in the Wall Street Journal from Saturday that there's a virtual war going on now between Facebook and Apple, because Apple is totally restricting Facebook's access to information about Apple clients. And that's like cutting off somebody's oxygen supply, because their model, you know, and apparently Tim Cook always reminds me of someone who's kind of cool, you know, I mean, not cool in a fashionable sense, but I think he he kind of looks like he's kind of unperturbable, you know,
right.
He's an unperturbable. But apparently, Mark Zuckerberg is just ranting and raving about Apple, and we're going to destroy Apple. We're going to inflict pain on Apple. And I said, you know, the one who's talking in that, you know, in that particular vein, emotional vein, is probably feeling that they're losing something, you know?
Yes.
Because Apple's got a pretty good record of privacy, you know, that they,
yeah,
you know, they have billboards of saying our business is to stay out of yours, you know,
mm-hmm.
and everything. So it's really, really interesting. The warlords are fighting.
It's true. Yeah. And that's, you know, that is, it's just that Apple is actually going to give people the choice. They're not cutting it out. They're saying,
no, they're
hey,
just
do
saying,
know
you have a choice.
These guys, yeah. Do you want to give these choice. Guys permission to track you everywhere you go? Right.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because when I open my Apple sites every day, it says in the last 3 weeks, 235 people have tried to track you and we've prevented it. You know,
wow.
You know, they give me a scorecard every day of what they're doing on my behalf. And
that's great.
Yeah. And I said, well, that's cool.
Yeah.
Cool. And I have evidence that it's true because the ads that are appearing as I'm reading articles and that never are anything that I, unless I've already indicated some sort of interest in this.
Right.
It's not just that I've mentioned a word or I mentioned a thought or anything. It's like where I really looked at, I really did look at running shoes. Okay.
Well, this is,
and
so I'll tell you how scary it is. So this morning, Valentine's Day, and Luba was showing me, cause I'm getting her this special tripod that moves to follow your when you move kind of thing for her training. Mm-hmm. She wanted this. So she was showing me on her phone, she was showing me this thing that she wanted to show it to me. And I just was watching this video on her phone, and then literally 2 hours later, on my phone, I'm getting this video showing up on my Facebook news feed.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, like, how in the world does that, are they tracking through my iPhone what I'm looking at on someone else's iPhone? I mean,
yeah.
In proximity, I guess. I mean, that's pretty wild, actually, you know?
Yeah. And, it's, and they're doing it because they can do it, you know, in
yeah.
other words, the virtual capabilities are there for them to do it. But what they don't what they don't take into account is that if people develop an emotion about this, and it's the emotion is against what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
They're screwed.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, because human emotions can go contagious. Or we,
yeah.
You know, just let's just cut these people off, you know. And so one thing that I can leave it with this, going back to the GameStop incident about a month ago, and it's kind of, a compliment to the genius of Elon Musk, because Elon Musk about 5 years ago was warring against the short, you know, the people who were shorting his stock.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, he was going on that. And I think that Elon Musk has figured out a new term was created over the last 4 weeks, and it's called sentiment investing. Sentiment. People have sentiments. And,
okay, yeah.
I'd never seen that term before, but that the Reddit community developed a sentiment against a hedge fund against hedge funds. They've developed a sentiment. And three million investors with 10,000 each, that's $30 billion. That's $30 billion.
Yeah.
You can create some really powerful short range investment movement with $30 billion suddenly in the market. And I think what Elon Musk recognized is that I'm always going to be the hero to the people who hate the hedge fund people.
Right.
And so he's occupying a spot on the other side of the sentiment divide where whatever Elon wants, we're for it.
Yeah.
Because there's no way you can justify the Tesla value evaluation in the marketplace based on the actual performance.
Well, there's sentiment. I see what's happening. Like right now, I don't know if you know or follow that in recent years, Taylor Swift had her catalog, her back catalog was bought by Scooter Braun and ultimately sold to a private equity firm. But Taylor does not own her catalog for her first six albums. And so it's become this big thing. And so she now is re-recording her first six albums to own her own masters of this now. And the first of these songs was released this week. And they're showing now and tracking how the sentiment of people buying the new, it's the new love story, but then in brackets, Taylor's version or whatever the thing was to make it that all of her fans who know the whole story are supporting buying her version.
She's declaring ownership, and ownership is more than just the legal contract that backs it up, it's a very, very interesting topic. And
sentiment, it's involved. Sentiment is her audience is supporting it, this to screw the big, money guys.
It's just an observation on my part, and it's my opinion. But I think the reason why Trump did that speech, on the January 6th that got him impeached, is that he's got a really good hold, a sentimental hold on 74 million voters. He had to go right to the final moment that he was there for them, regardless of what kind of backlash he got, and everything like that. And he now, he sits there and he's got 74 million chips. He started with 74 million chips, and everybody's going to have to beat a pilgrimage to Mar-a-Lago to, if they want to be anything in the Republican Party over the next 4 years, they got to beat it.
Yeah.
They have to make a pilgrimage to Mar-a-Lago and plead their case, because he's got 74 million voters,
Wild.
Sentiment's a big thing. Sentiment's a big thing.
Yeah.
Don't be a jerk.
Well, I can't believe it's been an hour already.
We've exhausted it.
We've exhausted it. Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to our first Clubhouse Cloudlandia.
Yes, me too. I'll talk with Lee.
Yeah, see, that's a good practical goal for me.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, this would be, there'd be nothing that we couldn't, join in and have a conversation with people. There'd be people who join in and listen and contribute. Yep. It'd be great. Yep.
Okay.
All right, Dan.
Okay.
I'll talk to you soon. Bye.